Mark Tidd grew up in a Navy family, attended Williams College in Massachusetts, and then came to Colorado Springs where he met his wife Jennifer, and he also was on the staff of the Dale House. And after he finished and after I was had a year of seminary, we were mutually looking for roommates, and I think it was George Sheffer that matched us up.
Yeah.
And so for the better part of a great year before we both went back to Fuller, we were roommates. And then when we got to Fuller, we were in a couples group for 3 years, Nancy and Mark and Jennifer. And we sort of went our different ways. And about 10 years ago, we got back in touch when I returned to Colorado Springs, and we have been in conversation. And one of the happy occasions in my life was to worship at this church with Mark and Jennifer on the occasion of Mark's promotion to the Chief of Navy Chaplains. And that really was when I began to have the first inkling that of a call here. And so it's great that with all of that working out, we're here to be with our good friends. Mark went to Fuller Seminary along with me and also did a THM at Princeton Seminary. He has... You don't get to be the Chief of Navy Chaplains without a long list of accomplishments, and some of those he's going to talk to you about tonight, and there are others on the website, and I'm not going to give you any more of a rundown and take away Mark's time, but we are delighted to have Mark here tonight, and it's really a great pleasure to have an old friend, and so let's welcome Rear Admiral Mark Tidd.
Thanks, Glenn. Thanks very much. Well, thanks very much. It really is a privilege to be here tonight and to be with you all. I've been looking forward to this because I think it's going to be a fun evening. We'll talk about some things and have some opportunity for discussion. Now, I need to begin with something that's pretty standard for folks that work in government and work in the military, and that's a disclaimer. And so I need to tell you that the views I'm going to talk about are my own views. They don't necessarily reflect the views of the Department of the Navy or the Department of Defense. And I'll come back to that a little bit later. But, Quinn, thanks again so much for the invitation. It really is wonderful to be here, although, in fact, it is a little bit daunting to be part of such a select group of folks as you've had as speakers. I travel a pretty fair bit and so haven't been able to be here for each one of the Wednesday night events, but I was here a couple of weeks ago for the event, for the talk by Daryl Guter, who is an old friend and mentor, and he just did a brilliant and gracious job of talking about mission shaped by the cross. So with him, with Jeff McCrory, another friend, I'm honored and a little intimidated to be part of that group. But I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts with you tonight about leadership at the foot of the cross, or leadership shaped by the cross, or leadership in the light of the cross. It's been my privilege to serve on active duty as a Navy chaplain for going on 29 years this summer, but I think I'll make it a career. Jennifer will tell you, and Jennifer is here with us tonight, I think Jennifer will tell you that it's been an adventure that we just never could have imagined when we met at Dale House a few years ago. And what I usually tell people is we met at Dale House, group home for troubled adolescents, and Jennifer was on staff. So, and I'll leave it at that. Now, when Quinn preached Sunday before last about longing for home, that started a train of thought in my mind, thinking about how many times I've moved. As Quinn said, I came from a Navy family. Jennifer also came from a Navy family. So either with Jennifer together or as the son of a Navy officer, it's probably something close to 30 times that I've moved, and Jennifer probably also, over the course of my life. And I'm not quite yet 60. Although I can see it. When people ask me, just making small talk, so where's home for you? I tell people it's wherever Jennifer is. That's where my home is. We've lived overseas 3 times. Now, for some of my State Department colleagues, that probably is not that much. But we've had the privilege of living overseas three times in very different cultures. We started out in Japan, where our son Michael was born. Our second overseas tour was in Bahrain. How many of you know where Bahrain is? Some of you do. For those of you who don't, it's a small island in the Persian Gulf, or as we sometimes say, in the Arabian Gulf. And I won't get into the reasons for that. It was a great experience. Jennifer and our children, Mike and Carol, arrived on September 3rd, 2001. Very interesting time. They were just coming out of jet lag on September 11th. Very intense time for us to be overseas. And yet, in many ways, for us, it was our best family tour. A tremendous sense of community among the staff there who were working incredibly hard, doing great work on behalf of our nation. And it was a great cross-cultural experience for us, and particularly for our children, who were going to school with children from around the world, to include many from the Middle East. And so they had an experience at that particular time that I think was invaluable for them and has stood them in good stead. So, and then our final overseas tour was 3 years in Germany. That's a little unusual. If I was in the Army, no big deal. If I was in the Air Force, no big deal. It's a little unusual for a Navy officer, but I had a rare opportunity to spend 3 years in Germany before coming back here to Washington, D.C. And it was a great, great experience working at U.S. European Command, which is our joint command in charge of all military forces throughout Europe. And at the time, it also included forces that were providing support in Africa. Well, we feel like we have lived out the phrase, join the Navy and see the world. And we've certainly done the around the world tour portion of that. But you know, the heart of what we've done has been, the heart of our experience has been the people that we've served. Now, some of you may know, but perhaps some don't, that Navy chaplains serve not only in Navy commands, but also in Marine commands. We provide chaplains as well as doctors and corpsmen to Marine units. Navy chaplains also serve with the Coast Guard. Now, we have a smaller number of folks that have had Coast Guard duty. I unfortunately have not had that opportunity, although Jennifer's a little grateful because that would have meant yet another set of uniforms that would have taken even more closet space, and she doesn't get much as it is. But I've had the privilege of serving on a guided missile cruiser that was homeported in Japan, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier out of Norfolk. Had two tours in 2nd Marine Division out of Camp Lejeune. Both times, the whole division staff deployed for combat, first in Desert Storm and then later in Operation Iraqi Freedom. Served twice now in Washington, D.C. For some reason, that's not considered a combat tour. Not sure why. And then have had the opportunity to attend school a couple of places, to include National War College here in D.C., which was one of the greatest years of reflection and study and interaction throughout my career, and have also been at our Navy chaplain school. It's the sailors and the Marines and their families that we remember most, whether it's in chapel or at sea or ashore far away, walking with them through the challenges and the pressures of military life, celebrating with them in times of joy, sharing their grief in times of loss, saying evening prayer over the ship's loudspeaker system just before taps at night, or watching with the ship's lookouts on the bridge wings as the bioluminescence of the South Seas at night seems to stretch like a warm glow for miles around in the darkness. Those are special times to share with our Marines and sailors. So I really do appreciate Quinn's invitation. This has given me an opportunity to put together some thoughts that I've been thinking about for quite some time, reflecting on, both as a chaplain in my career, but also in particular as chief of chaplains right now. So I'd like to share some thoughts about leadership and faith, which I think for Christians is reflected in the title, Leadership at the Foot of the Cross. But we probably ought to begin with a bit of definition. What's leadership? Now, if you look in the literature, there are lots of different definitions. I came across a couple I'll share with you. Harry Truman was not known for beating around the bush. He said that a leader is a man who has the ability to get other people to do what they don't want to do and like it. That's an interesting definition of leadership. I didn't hear that one in seminary, by the way. Pulled one out of the war instructions from the U.S. Navy during 1944. Leadership is the art of inspiring, guiding, and directing bodies of men, this was World War II, so that they ardently desire to do what the leader wishes. Now, that's not too bad. But for my money, I think probably the best definition I've come across recently is one by an Australian author, John Dixon, who wrote a book last year entitled Humilitas, a Lost Key to Life, Love, and Leadership. And I'll mention him again a little bit later. But his definition is leadership is the art of inspiring others in a team to contribute their best towards a goal. I really like that. That resonates with me. Leadership is an art. It's not a science exactly, although we teach lots of classes, certainly in the military, on leadership. It's not something that you can do just according to a checklist. There's some art involved. It requires inspiring or moving others, persuasion as much as control, even in the military, influence as much as the authority that comes from the position that a commander might have. Of course, it involves working with people, a team. There's a relational element to it. And there's a goal, a purpose, a mission, a vision. So I think that's a pretty good starting point as we think about what is leadership. And then we'll go from there in a few different directions. Now, I began tonight with the disclaimer that these are my own views, not necessarily the views of the Department of Defense or the Department of the Navy. Why did I say that? Partly to reflect the fact that as a Navy officer, I am one who is under authority. I've taken an oath to the Constitution. And these words will be very familiar to many of you. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter. So help me God. How many of you have taken a similar oath? I know a number of you have taken that exact one or something similar, very similar to it. So I'm under the authority that's imposed by taking that oath. But I'm also under another authority as well, without a doubt. I'm under authority as a minister of word and sacrament. But ultimately, I'm under authority as a disciple. Jesus dealt with people who understood what it was to be under authority. I want to share with you a few verses from Matthew, and I'm going to look at three different passages tonight. The first one I want to look at is from Matthew chapter 8. And this will be familiar to you. When Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him. Now, a centurion is a soldier, but it's still close to my heart as a sailor. A centurion came to him, appealing to him and saying, "Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed in terrible distress." And he said to him, "I will come and cure him." The centurion answered, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only speak the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and the slave does it." When Jesus heard him, he was amazed and said to those who followed, "Truly, I tell you, in no one in Israel have I found such faith." And then he closes, and to the centurion Jesus said, "Go, let it be done for you according to your faith." And the servant was healed in that hour. The centurion understood what it meant to be under authority and how hard it can be sometimes. As a Navy officer, as a chaplain, as a chief of chaplains, I'm under authority. I'm required to obey the lawful orders of my boss, the Chief of Naval Operations, of the Secretary of the Navy, the Secretary of Defense, the President, and I have loyalty to the Constitution. You see, I'm part of an institution, the military institution, the armed forces, and specifically the Navy. I provide ministry within the walls of that institution. And it's important to remember, this institution is not fundamentally a religious institution. The Navy is not a church. It's not fundamentally a religious institution, but it has traditions and it has imperatives in it. And one of those is that fundamentally the military is an institution that has as one of its core principles subordination to civilian authority, certainly embodied in the President, but others as well, such as the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of the Navy. And that's critical because the nation has entrusted the military with a monopoly on the disciplined and lethal use, the disciplined and principled use of lethal force on behalf of the nation, not for its own sake, for its own power, but for use on behalf of the nation. And that principle is reflected in the special trust and confidence that's embodied in the commission of every military officer. So as a member of the military, and specifically the Navy, I'm required to obey all lawful orders, such as getting on board ship before it gets underway for deployment, or getting on a plane that will take my unit to a combat theater. Jennifer and I were talking about this past weekend, and there are a couple of times that were particularly memorable for her in terms of recalling times when I had to obey orders. The first was driving me to the middle of a field in Camp Lejeune in the middle of the night, in the pouring rain as it turned out, to get on a bus with Marines and then to fly with them to Saudi Arabia for Desert Storm. And this was before we had any idea of how it turned out. And you may remember, there were some grave predictions and grave preparations in terms of what might happen. The second time was some years later, driving in a minivan from our home in Virginia Beach down to the piers in Norfolk so I could go on board the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt and get underway for a six-month deployment to the Mediterranean Sea and the Arabian Gulf. And our two children were with us, and both of them in elementary school. To be honest, both of those times were very emotional events, certainly for Jennifer and Michael and Carol, and for me as well. Now, some years later, I was in Iraq in a place called Ramadi at a time when it was pretty brutal there. I was with 2nd Marine Division. In fact, I was the division chaplain for 2nd Marine Division, and we had several thousand Marines over there as part of our force. And usually once or twice a week, I would get together with the division surgeon and the division psychiatrist. We were the three senior Navy officers in this large Marine organization. And so once or twice a week, we would get together for our own Navy professional development and team building. And I have to admit, cigars may have been involved. The division psychiatrist made an observation one evening that really struck home. He said, you know, and he spent a lot of time with folks that were at times pretty troubled about what they were doing and under a great deal of stress. But he said, you know, every Marine and sailor that boarded the plane to come over here is a hero. Everyone obeyed orders, knowing what might well be in store. It wasn't easy, but they did it. And he was right. They did it. They obeyed the orders. Now, as chief of chaplains, I lead a chaplain corps of about 840 active duty chaplains. and about 240 reserve chaplains. The changes over the past several decades reflect the pluralism of our nation. During World War II, we had about 10 religious bodies that endorsed people to be candidates to be chaplains. We call them endorsers or endorsing agents. Well, in the 1970s, that number had reached 100. And now, today, we have just over 200 different religious bodies who endorse people to be candidates to be chaplains. Now, that number's a little, I won't say deceptive, but it may be misleading because I'm from the PCUSA. The Presbyterian Church in America has a different endorsing body. The Orthodox Presbyterian Church has another endorser, and there are two or three others for Presbyterians. For Baptists, there are probably six or eight different endorsing agencies. So it's not necessarily we have 200 completely radically different religions, but we do have quite a variety. And of those 200 religious bodies, approximately 100 of those are represented by chaplains and the Navy right now. So we have rabbis and imams. We have Catholic priests, Roman Catholics, and other Catholics. We have Orthodox priests. We have the full spectrum of the Protestant world as well. Kind of like America, we represent quite a variety of religious convictions and backgrounds. Now, as you can well imagine, this variety of religious bodies doesn't have one theology that we all share in common. So our unofficial motto as chaplains is cooperation without compromise. We expect to cooperate with each other without compromising our core faith convictions. This is grounded in the First Amendment, which, as you know, guarantees both the free exercise of religion and also no establishment of any one religion. Well, in this particular institutional environment, respect is crucial. It's respect not necessarily for somebody else's beliefs. We may disagree deeply theologically, but it's respect for a person's fundamental right to choose his or her own deepest convictions and beliefs, which at heart are inevitably religious. What's my purpose in life? What gives life meaning? What do I believe about God? What do I believe God expects of me? What's my relationship with God? So as Chief of Chaplains, I lead a corps that comes from about 100 different religious bodies. I don't tell them what to believe because I know they wouldn't listen if I tried to. But I lead them in figuring out how to work together so that we can serve our people, which is our whole reason for existence. So in some ways, I think the first thing about leadership at the foot of the cross is recognizing that we are as those who are under authority, for now and conditionally under civil authority or perhaps under military authority. Ultimately, we're under the authority of the one who died on the cross. The centurion acknowledged that he was one who was under authority, but he also acknowledged that he himself had authority to command his soldiers, to tell his servant what to do. You know, sometimes we are kind of skeptical about power and authority, perhaps because we know how badly they can be used. So I want to turn to another passage. This one is from also from the Gospel of Matthew, but from chapter 10. Another familiar passage. This is when Jesus was sending his apostles. Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to cure every disease and every sickness. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions: go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. As you go, proclaim the good news. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. you received without payment, give without payment. And then going down towards the end, he says, see, I am sending you out like sheep into the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. When Jesus sent out the 12, he gave them two things. He gave them authority over evil spirits to cast them out. But he also gave them a warning. See, I am sending you out like sheep into the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Now, why would Jesus do that? Why would he intentionally send his disciples into a dangerous environment? And it was eventually going to be very dangerous. Jesus went on to talk about the fact that they will hand you over to councils and they'll flog you. You'll be dragged before governors and kings. Brother will betray brother to death, and children will betray parents and vice versa. And you'll be hated by all because of my name. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. Well, it makes me wonder, are there things that he wanted the disciples to learn from that experience that they could learn in no other way? Why was that the best way for them to learn what he wanted them to learn? What did the disciples learn from that experience? So I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Now, because he sends us out, and I believe he does, as sheep among wolves, we've got to know what we're doing. When Jesus sends us, ignorance is not bliss. He gave the disciples authority over unclean spirits. He gave them power. They needed to know what they were doing because it was a dangerous environment. They needed wisdom. But it wasn't just the environment that was dangerous. It wasn't just the wolves. It was also the authority that could be dangerous. The power over unclean spirits. Power and authority are important. They're tools to get things done, but they can corrupt. So in addition to being wise as serpents, we must be innocent as doves. Jesus intentionally sends as sheep among wolves all of us and tells us that we must be wise as serpent and innocent as doves. We need both wisdom and innocence in a fallen world and in a fallen institution. Imagine for a moment, if you will, a matrix of four squares. Now, I don't have a flip chart up here that I can draw on, But imagine for a moment four squares. The vertical axis would be character, and the horizontal axis would be competence. So that gives you four combinations. Think about leadership and think about employees in your organization. Somebody who is of low character and low competence probably don't have to worry too much about them because they're probably not going to last in the organization very long, whatever the organization may be. If you have somebody who is of high character but low competence, they may be nice folks, but they probably also won't last too long because of their lack of competence. Somebody who's of high character and high competence, that's ideal. That's who you're looking for. That's who you want, certainly as a member of your team or as your leader. But we've got a fourth square. What about the person who is of low character and high competence? That's the dangerous one. That's the one that you've got to watch. Countless leaders in history have had high competence in leadership but low character. And just during the 20th century, that's cost us millions of lives. But innocent wisdom or wise innocence is a key to building trust. And trust is critical for leaders. For military leaders, and certainly for others, but also for military leaders, there is a moral imperative to competence in their profession. That's especially true in leadership on the battlefield or leadership at sea. Those leaders have to know their profession well because people's lives depend on it. Those whom they lead and others as well. Each one they lead must ultimately know, for example, when to pull the trigger, and perhaps more importantly, when not to. That's the mark of a true professional. That's why accountability is so absolute when it comes to military leaders. With great authority comes great responsibility and great accountability. Accountability for their professional competence. For naval officers, that's competence, highly developed competence in engineering, in ship handling, in seamanship, in training. But there's also accountability for personal conduct. So we must be wise as serpents. And when I talk about wisdom, I think of competence. And we must be innocent as doves. And I think of character. Now, it occurs to me that doves are also used for sacrifices, which brings us back to the foot of the cross. The wisdom of serpents and the innocence of doves is not a formula for escaping suffering. And at the foot of the cross, we're reminded of another aspect of the one whom we follow, and that's the aspect of servanthood. Let me turn to John chapter 13, a great portrait of leadership. Now, before the festival of the Passover, and this was his final one, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The devil had already put it into the heart of Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, to betray him. And during supper, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, got up from the table, took off his outer robe, and tied a towel around himself. And then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was tied around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus answered, "You do not know now what I'm doing, but later you will understand." Peter said to him, "You will never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Well, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "One who has bathed does not need to wash except for the feet, but is entirely clean." And then he goes on to say, "Do you know what I've done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right, for that is what I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have set you an example that you also should do as I have done to you." There was a book in 2001. Perhaps some of you saw it if you read about business leadership and management studies. It was a book called Good to Great. It was a bestseller written by Jim Collins. He examined a number of companies that had made the leap from being a pretty good company to one that was great. And he looked at companies like Gillette, Walmart, Kimberly-Clark, and a number of others. And the companies that had made the transition from being merely good to actually great had a few things in common, as you might expect. But in the process of the research that he and his team did, they made a completely unexpected discovery. The unexpected discovery was a particularly surprising quality of its leaders at the top, and he called them level 5 executives. Now, he had 4 other levels of people. The first level was the highly capable individual who can help make productive contributions, get the job done. The second level is a contributing team member who contributes his or her own individual capabilities to the achievement of group objectives, who can work well with others. Third level was a competent manager, and now you get into the management and the leadership part. A manager who organizes people and resources towards the effective and efficient pursuit of already determined objectives. The fourth level was the effective leader who catalyzes commitment and vigorous pursuit of a clear and compelling vision, stimulating higher performance standards. Now, that fourth level leader sounds pretty good to me, but he identified something unique about the fifth level leader that set that leader and that company apart from others. According to Collins, the level five executive builds enduring greatness through a paradoxical blend of personal humility and professional will. He goes on to say that level five leaders channel their ego needs away from themselves and into the larger goal of building a great company. It's not that level five leaders have no ego or self-interest. Indeed, they are incredibly ambitious, but their ambition is first and foremost for the institution, not themselves. Jim Collins found, much to his surprise, that the distinguishing mark of a leader who leads an organization to greatness is completely counterintuitive. Personal humility coupled with intense determination and commitment to a goal. But maybe that's not so counterintuitive after all. What sailors and Marines want to know above all is that their commander is profoundly committed to them. That if the commander must send them into combat, they will have been given the very best equipment and training that the commander can provide. That the mission is worth the risk of their lives. That the incredible U.S. military medical evacuation system will be behind them if they're wounded. That their leader cares about them far more than about personal career success. I mentioned a book by John Dixon, Humilitas, written last year. John Dixon makes, I think, a very compelling case that humility, supported by competence, is critical to building trust between leaders and followers. Any leader, whether in the military or in business or in the social sector, and certainly within the church, knows that trust between followers and leaders is absolutely critical. So recall, if you will, the night of the Last Supper. On this night, knowing that this was his last night with his disciples, what does Jesus want to say to them? What does he want to teach them? On this last night, what does Jesus do? Of course, we read that passage now from the vantage point of this side of the cross. So everything that happens, we see in the shadow of the cross, in the shadow of the suffering that was to follow. The chapters of John that I read tonight, John 13 through John 17, is a farewell address of sorts. And it includes a powerful prayer of Jesus on behalf of all who would follow him. But before he gets into the heart of his farewell address, he does something that no one expected. As surprising as he often was to the disciples, this was the most surprising, at least up until that point. He took on the job of the lowest servant, and he washed their feet. And clearly, Peter was shocked and distressed and maybe offended. Lord, no, you shouldn't do this. A pattern that Peter had trying to teach the Lord. But when Jesus explains, if I don't wash you, you have no share in me, Peter flips all the way to the other side and says, well, if you want to wash my feet, how about my hands and my face and my head? Wash all of me. Peter didn't quite get it, and Jesus was very, very gentle in correcting him. But I'm always encouraged by the example of Peter, because we're sometimes slow learners ourselves.
And so if there's hope for Peter, there's hope for me. Jesus, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, humbled himself. Now, there would be another humility soon enough. In fact, humiliation of a cruel and very public execution of the type reserved for only the lowest of criminals. But for now, he astonished and puzzled his disciples by taking on the lowest servant's job of washing their feet. Here's the leadership of the cross. The one who is himself wise beyond any serpent, including the first one in that garden long ago. The one whose character is innocent beyond the purest dove that's ever flown on this earth. This is the one who sacrifices himself for the sake of others, for our sakes, using power and authority that his Father had given to him, not for himself, but for us, on the cross and in the resurrection. Now, you may have heard it said that we cannot lead well unless, and first, we also follow well. Which brings us back to the centurion. I also am a man under authority. And he goes on to speak about those he leads and commands, his soldiers, his servants. But he begins by acknowledging that he is under authority himself, just as we are. And we are under the authority of the one who washed the feet of his disciples, who went from that upper room into the long night, finally to the cross for us. Leadership for us means knowing we also are under authority. It means we must be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. It means we lead not for the sake of getting power and authority for ourselves, but in order to use whatever power and authority we might have been given for the sake of those that we are called for a time to lead and to serve, even if it means washing dirty feet or dying on a cross. Now, few of us will be called to die, but leaders at the foot of the cross walk with their people through the valley of the shadow of death because we bring hope of the good news of the cross and the hope of the empty tomb. Thanks very much for your attention. Be glad to engage in some questions and answers.
We do have a minute before we take our break to begin some conversation with Mark. So I'll get Paul here.
Oops. Please.
Just wonder if you have any work with Ed Brogan, the chaplain of the Presbyterians here in this office. You work with him?
Just a little bit. If he gets mad at me, I lose my job. Ed Brogan, for those of you who don't know, is the director of the Presbyterian Council for Chaplains and Military Personnel. And so he's one of those 200 endorsing agents, very important person in my life because he's the one who endorses me. And I will tell you, this is an unsolicited commercial. Endorsers have a variety of reputations among chaplains. Our endorser, Ed Brogan, and many others before him have performed a tremendous ministry to Presbyterian chaplains. And many chaplains envy us as Presbyterian chaplains because of the care that they take for us. Wherever we've been, literally around the world with the exception of Bahrain because it was a little hard to get there during wartime, the endorsers have come to visit us. When we were in Camp Lejeune and I had left for Desert Storm, Jennifer, do you remember the names of the endorsers? Mac McMillan and Blant Ferguson came down to Camp Lejeune, gathered, and there were four Presbyterian chaplains that were stationed there, and we had all deployed for Desert Storm. Again, remember, we had no idea what was really going to happen.
He got the wives together, took them out to dinner. The two of them took our wives out to dinner and spent just a wonderful time with them, supporting them, ministering to them, reassuring them if something happened, they would be there for them. That was tremendous ministry. And they do that like few other endorsers do. The Presbyterian Council for Chaplains and Military Personnel, they're the ones who look out for the chaplains. So I am deeply grateful to them. Thanks for asking that question.
And just to clarify, that office is here in the agency's building. It has been. I'm going to get Mike. And then
whatever you do to support them, believe me, it is incredibly worthwhile. When I was sitting in the desert in Saudi Arabia, I got some other literature from another office of the Presbyterian Church that was not quite as pastorally uplifting at the time. And I'll leave it at that. But the support of the church where I was ordained, which was First Presbyterian Church in Colorado Springs, and the support of Mac McMillan and Blant Ferguson, that was a godsend to us.
Thank you for that wonderful talk on leadership. Last week we had a really interesting speaker talk. What was his center?
Ethics and public policy. Right.
And he was talking about trying to communicate with the press about issues of religion and faith and get a straight communication.
Right.
Now, it is my understanding that in the Navy, the line officers rate the chaplains.
Right.
And do you find, does that create problems given the multiplicity of backgrounds and belief systems and so on, having line officers doing that evaluations?
Yeah, great question. In the Navy, we call them fitness reports. And every commanding officer is charged with the duty of evaluating the fitness of his or her officers for further duty and so forth. And so that's an annual report that every commanding officer writes on every officer in his or her command. I think our culture is such that we have a pretty good understanding of what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. They don't write about Lieutenant Tidd's sermon last Sunday had the most egregious theological point in it that I've ever heard. But what they're concerned about, frankly, is are we out there taking care of the troops? And so what they evaluate us on is not our theological sophistication, but are we out there? If I'm with a Marine, I was a battalion chaplain for an infantry battalion. So one of the key things is, was I out there when the battalion had a hike, was I out there with them? When a company was out in the field, did I go spend time with them? They evaluate us on how good are we at getting out with our people, and then how good are we at problem solving when people bring us problems? How good are we at our basic pastoral counseling? They're pretty good about understanding that we got a variety of religious groups within America, and they're represented within the military, and so they understand that we don't get into the details of that. So I've been very pleased with my experience. We also have promotion boards, selection boards for promotion, just like everybody else in the Navy. And those boards, they meet every year. A board will typically have about 7 members on it. Now, for chaplain corps promotions, I'll typically, either I or my deputy, who is a 1-star rear admiral, will be the president of that board. But out of the 7 members, there will be 1 other chaplain, and then the rest are line officers or other staff corps officers. And so we have a good mix of people that provide an evaluation of that. Does that help answer your question?
We're at a point where we need to give folks 30 seconds to make transitions, and then we're going to come back with John Witherspoon's questions. So if you can stay, that's great. If you need to go to choir, we understand. And so don't run. Just stand up and stretch. We can have some Jeopardy music in the background.
I
Okay, I really meant it by 30 seconds, so we're gonna come back here.
Yeah, I like standing.
And Mark, are you ready for the next question?
Supervision a little bit, or
yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but we want
Who else has a question?
I was just wondering if you ever found yourself in conflict between your duties and obligations as a military officer and your position as a high official in religious services.
Right, yeah.
Did your religious beliefs ever in conflict with your obligations as a military officer?
I have never run into that. Now, are there times when I have to go see a commanding officer and close the door and say, you may want to rethink this particular direction that you're going in, or you need to hear what some of the feedback is about this particular situation? And that's a privilege that chaplains have because they've earned the trust and know how to use that trust appropriately. I have never been given an illegal order, for example. There are also some pretty good boundaries about what chaplains can and cannot be ordered to do. I'm a noncombatant under the Geneva Conventions. Now, actually, that's kind of interesting. Under the Geneva Conventions, I could carry a weapon, a defensive weapon. In fact, doctors and corpsmen are also noncombatants under the Geneva Conventions, but they're authorized to carry sidearms as a defensive weapon to protect their patients. It's U.S. military policy that chaplains shall not bear arms, so I don't bear arms at all. Now, I have an enlisted religious program specialist, we call him in the Navy, or a chaplain assistant in the Army and the Air Force. And that person is a combatant, and part of his duty is in the battlefield. They provide security for the chaplain and for themselves. So I look for the biggest RP I can find. And I prefer the expert marksman. So there are some things that are prescribed, and there's other things that are prescribed, particularly when we're in a combat environment, so that we don't jeopardize our status as noncombatants under the Geneva Conventions. But I've been very blessed. I've had some very good commanding officers. Had a couple other commanding officers as well, but for the most part, they've been great. And the ones that haven't been so great, I've had an opportunity to spend some time with them, and sometimes they didn't last long. Those are interesting opportunities for ministry as well. Does that answer your question, sir? Thanks.
In recent times, we've heard a lot about restrictions on religion within the military. Mm-hmm. I wonder how it has affected your ministry. Are they really making it much more difficult for you to minister than in the past?
That's a great question. I appreciate your asking that, because there's sort of an urban legend out there that, you know, there are things that we can't do. One of the ways that this came up was a lot of discussion a few years ago about can you pray in Jesus' name? Let me set the scene for you a bit. We have some opportunities as chaplains, particularly in the Navy. It's part of Navy tradition. We have opportunities to participate in public ceremonies, in command ceremonies, like a change of command most typically, and we're invited to provide an invocation and a benediction. All members of the command are required to be there. Now, when I prepare for that, I think about, is this the time for really doing evangelism with folks that are required to be there? Or is there a way that I can craft my prayer so that it includes as many people as possible and maybe open some doors for folks to reflect on some more spiritual realities without putting those who don't believe in God at all or have very specific beliefs about them? Are there ways that I can speak to them effectively and open a door? In a sense, it's not evangelism, it's pre-evangelism. So I have never felt like I had to pray with a particular formula. I am humbly confident that God hears my prayer, and God also changes my prayers so that I pray the way I ought rather than the way I sometimes want to. God knows
what the prayer ought to be, and sometimes in spite of the words. So I don't feel like I have to pray in a particular formulaic way. That's been the cause or the source of some litigation, for example, and we've had some interesting experiences with that. But I have not felt like there's a limitation on me to carry out ministry or on my chaplains to carry out ministry. Now, there are times when it's appropriate. When you're in, you know, when you're in a chapel setting in worship, and that's a specifically Christian or a specifically Protestant setting, tremendous freedom. When you're in a command function, you got to think through what's really the role there. Sometimes chaplains can be tempted to make that their opportunity to preach, so their invocation is longer than the speech of the commanding officer. That doesn't reflect well on us. It sort of has the opposite. So we try to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Does that help answer your question? Thanks. Yeah.
Mark, I want to pick up on the criteria you mentioned in the fitness report. Mm-hmm. You said one of the criteria was problem solving. Mm-hmm. And I think we all appreciate that the difficulties that we put our soldiers, our military into right now involve a lot of mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you'd say something about how you relate to the mental health people. Do you have the same confidentiality protection that doctors do or lawyers do? And how does that work out?
Yeah.
And
great question.
How are you processing what you're learning as you get feedback from people that come back from the front lines?
And there are two or three questions in there, and they're all great. Let me touch on the confidentiality. Chaplains have absolute confidentiality, which nobody else has. And in fact, I was in a meeting today with another flag officer who's in charge of a number of our programs to combat suicide, for example, and sexual assault and some other areas, alcohol abuse. And her perspective is that chaplains have a unique capability that we offer, which is that absolute confidentiality. Because what that does for us, in many ways, we are the pressure relief valve for a command. An XO of a destroyer said to me, the greatest capability I have is to be able to send a sailor who's really wrestling with something to go see the chaplain, and that sailor can bare his or her soul and talk about whatever is on their minds, and that sailor knows it won't get around the ship and can really deal with whatever it is that they're dealing with. And that's the absolute confidentiality that we have. And that's based in part on the tradition of the priest-penitent relationship. So that's something that's pretty unique for us. And I think we have to do a better job of talking about the value of that. And so I talk about that when I'm talking with at our command leadership school in Newport, talking to prospective COs and XOs. In terms of working with the mental health providers, one of the things we don't want to do is say we got all the answers. But we work in partnership. We're an essential partner to our mental health providers. And there are things that chaplains can't do. I mean, we are not therapists. We do basic pastoral counseling. But often we're the gateway to folks getting more help, whether it's psychological, medical, whatever. But sometimes they won't go see the doctor. They won't go see the psychiatrist. It's safer to go see the chaplain. There's stigma is a bad thing. Wish we didn't have that problem, but we do have it. Sometimes it's easier for people to get access because, number one, the chaplain's familiar out and about the decks and the working spaces and out in the field. Number two, you can talk to the chaplain about any number of things. If you're talking to a psychiatrist, that sort of narrows the range down. When people know that you're talking to the psychiatrist. So we can help them work through what are the real priorities here and what's the help that we need to get and earn their trust and help them get the kind of help they need. Now, how do we process the things we hear? When I was division chaplain in Iraq, I had three regimental chaplains. We had three regiments over there. and there was a chaplain at each one of the regiments. And each regiment had three battalions, and each battalion had a chaplain. What we spent a lot of time doing was talking about how do we support each other. And frankly, I saw, in addition to some of the administrative and management stuff, my biggest responsibility was to spend time with those regimental chaplains and to hear what they were going through and to provide them really personal pastoral support. And their biggest responsibility was to do the same for their battalion chaplains. And we've kind of made that a culture. But there's more that we can do. So we're working on, for example, some retreats with our chaplains who are assigned to Marine units called spiritual resiliency retreats. We've done one on the West Coast. We're about to do another one on the East Coast. We're always looking at how can we do that better. But I take that as one of the key roles of the leader, of a chaplain leader. In a sense, we're pastors to pastors. That's not entirely, I mean, that's not absolutely true, but there's a role for that. Does that answer your question? Thanks.
We're got one here.
Oh, I wasn't going to bother. Huh? This is, what do you, in terms of this of your talk, I was interested in humility. Where is creativity in leadership? Mm-hmm. And in the change of women mm-hmm. position, mm-hmm. how has that affected the chaplaincy of our country?
I mean, I think it's, we have drawn on the gifts in ministry that women have. My deputy, the deputy chief of chaplains, and that position is double-headed as chaplain of the Marine Corps. My deputy is a woman. She's our first female chaplain flag officer, and she does just, she's a superb chaplain. And Quinn knows her, Margaret Kibben, also Presbyterian, which is a little unusual. But she's super. And we've been able to draw, yeah. And we complement, I think we complement each other. But that's true wherever we work. Now, the reality is we have about 100 different religious groups represented in our chaplain corps, and some of those groups don't ordain women. So one of the key issues is if you're coming into the chaplain corps, are you able to work with female leadership? And we ask our candidates about that and have some pretty frank discussions about that. And if they're just not able to do that, then we certainly affirm their call to ministry, but not in the Navy. It's just the nature of the institution that we're a part of. Does that answer your question? In terms of humility or in terms of creativity, we got some incredibly creative chaplains. And one of the things I really enjoy about my travels is the opportunity to see them out doing different things, creative things with the troops. We got some great folks, and it really is a privilege to be their chief of chaplains.
We're going to take one last question.
Okay.
Someone's been waiting patiently.
Okay.
And then you'll just have to handle it on your own.
Got it.
You've probably done that before.
This is just a quick follow-on to an earlier question. What about prayers on the ship? Do you ever get complaints about public prayers? Because we hear so much about that here in schools and public places.
Actually, that takes me to another point that I forgot to make earlier. We have the tradition when a ship is at sea that has a chaplain embarked that we do evening prayer. And typically it's at 21:55 or 9:55 in the evening, which is 5 minutes before taps. And so typically it's the tradition is that we're able to do evening prayer. It goes throughout the whole ship. My first tour on board a ship, I was on a cruiser. I was the only chaplain, and so I did that every night. And for me, that was a very special time. It was a sacred time. It was an opportunity, and frankly, I would go up to the bridge and spend some time with the lookouts on the bridge wings, just talking with them, and then spend some time just staring at the ocean, which, I mean, I'm a sailor. I'm not a soldier. I love the ocean. And I found that very enriching. And I would compose my prayer, and what I would do would be to try and capture some of what went on that day, or was there a particular individual that stood out, and hold that person up before God and ask for God's blessings on us. And I try to do that in a way that as many people as possible could say amen to. I would also keep it short. I mean, I aim for about 60 to 90 seconds. Now, one of the things that, one of the learning and growth experiences for a new chaplain is to learn that you don't have to preach the whole gospel in one sermon. You don't have to say everything in one prayer. And if you're going much more than that, you're going to lose folks. That's something that it's just a practical reality. So how do you say something that's short and to the point, but that makes a difference? So I did have, in all of my time on board ship, I did have one person who complained about my prayers and felt like we shouldn't be doing this at all. Why are we doing this? It was a chief. And so I sat down with the chief and said, let's talk. How are things going? What's going on in your life? It actually turned in, it was a cry for help. It turned into a profound pastoral experience, and he became a great advocate for what we were doing. So I've had pretty good response to that. Now, if you're going 5 minutes or longer on a prayer, remembering that some folks are also probably trying to sleep during that time, you'll get a lot more complaints.
And we are 5 minutes past 8 o'clock. So let's thank Mark. What I'm going to do is I want you to lead us in prayer for Mark and his ministry, and then if you'd like to still engage him, feel free to come forward.
Yep.
Okay, let us pray. Yep. Gracious God, we are grateful for Mark and Jennifer that they are part of this congregation on many Sundays, and we thank you for blessing the United States military and the Navy with the great leadership of Mark. Father, we lift him up to you, and we pray that you would richly bless all that he does and the myriad tasks that he performs, and as he leads those pastors to our sailors and to our Marines and to those who are guarding the coast. Father, would you anoint his leadership that in the broadest and most comprehensive way that your grace might be known to the men and women of the armed services. So we commit his work to you, and we thank you for him and for this night. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.